dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding,
you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, or WXXC Truxton. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last Thursday was International Women's Day. Much as we consider it rather inadequate to have only one day to acknowledge the issues confronting more than half the people on the planet, tonight we're going to take the opportunity to feature a collection of contemporary women active in a variety of areas: the environment, labor, democracy, and in defense of non-patriarchal, earth-centered religious practice. We're going to devote the first hour to a documentary commemorating the life of the much-mourned and courageous Judy Berry of Earth First, who passed on in 1997 at the age of 48 years from cancer, after surviving a bomb blast several years earlier that was meant to take her life and stop her work. In the second hour, we'll hear from three women activists, Cindy Milstein, Alexis Buss, and Jerry Hildebrand. An interesting historical note apropos of Women's Day. Our theme song, Unwelcome Guests, is about an outlaw who robs from the rich and gives to the poor. There were, in fact, actual historical figures who did just that, both in 17th century England and in 19th century America. Though, alas, they may not have had a horse called Black Bess. But there were also highway women. Indeed, the very first English highwayman was a woman, Mary Frith of London, nicknamed Moll Cutpurse, who, as well as being a fence and pickpocket, spent several years of her life between 1584 and 1659 robbing travelers on Hounslow Heath, including Oliver Cromwell's man, General Fairfax. Dressing in men's clothing and capable of swearing like a trooper, Moll became famous enough to have a play, The Roaring Girl, written about her within her own lifetime. Sometimes the most famous highway women worked with men as partners, but as a firm equal to them. Joan Phillips eloped with her lover Edward Bracy when her father refused them permission to marry, and after falling in with Bracy's cousin, Swift Nix Nevison, the couple were quick to follow in his footsteps. Joan adopted the pseudonym of John, and dressed in male clothing, robbed the coaches both with her husband and alone. She was captured while carrying out a lone robbery in 1685 and hanged in Nottingham. The discovery that John Phillips, the highwayman who had terrorized the countryside, was a woman, astounded the public. When Sarah Davis went to hang at Tyburn in 1705, she had already outlived two male partners. Mary Blackett, who followed her there in 1726, had turned to highway robbery while her husband was away at sea, perhaps because she was short of money, perhaps just for excitement. The best-known highwaywoman is Catherine Ferrers, whose life was dramatized and distorted in the movie Wicked Lady. The fictional character is portrayed as a scheming femme fatale who wrongs her admirable husband, who she first stole from her devoted and kind cousin. This was hardly the reality. Rather, she was a young woman who yearned for action and excitement, who was trapped in the role of trophy wife. Born in 1662 to a rural landed family, she was made to marry elderly nobleman Sir Ralph Ferrers at age 16. Her husband took more interest in his financial dealings than his wife, and Catherine found life increasingly tedious. Talk of a highwayman traveling the local roads gave her the idea of disguising herself with a collection of spare men's clothing kept in the house and venturing out onto nearby Watling Street to rob the coaches. her first victim was her own sister-in-law. Leaving and returning by way of a secret passage running from her room to the grounds, she became the terror of the neighborhood following a series of daring robberies. Catherine pursued her career for excitement and had little need of the money and valuables she stole. These were hidden, along with her disguise, in a room above the kitchen. In 1683, she attempted to rob a lone traveler and, to her shock, found herself staring down the barrel of a pistol. The other highwayman, Jerry Jackson, commanded her to unmask and was astonished to find himself faced with a woman. He and Catherine became partners, meeting after dark and combing the countryside for victims. Their adventures were not to end until Lady Ferrer's house steward informed her in private that he had seen her leaving the house late at night and guessed her secret. He was reluctant to see shame brought on the family, and agreed to keep her previous activities from her husband if she would stop them immediately. To which she consented. A year later, the elderly servant had died, taking her secret with him. Jerry Jackson had since been captured and hanged, but Catherine was still hungry for excitement. However, by now, her luck had run out. She was shot and wounded while robbing a coach near St. Albans, and her horse carried her home to die at the door of her own room, where her horrified husband found her. He buried her quietly and closed off her secret room, believing it would be the end of her story. According to local legend, the most famous of highway women now lays at rest in an unmarked grave. Now, Revolutionary Ecology, produced by Noel Hanrahan.
Earth First activists Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney are under arrest.
The white Subaru they were riding in suddenly exploded, blowing out the windows and the driver's door, buckling the roof, leaving burn marks on the roadway.
Today, police say the couple knew they were driving around with a bomb inside.
The evidence strongly points to the fact that they were possessing and transporting that device when it detonated.
Police believe the bomb was being carried in a guitar case owned by Judy Barry.
On May 24, 1990, a bomb wrapped in nails for shrapnel effect went off under the driver's seat of Earth First activist Judy Barry's car. Judy was nearly killed by the attempted assassination. Her pelvis literally exploded. And it was only through the force of her will that she ever walked again. Fellow Earth Firster Daryl Cherney, who was beside her in the passenger seat, suffered facial cuts and broken eardrums. The FBI terrorist squad arrived on the scene within 25 minutes and framed these nonviolent activists for the bombing that was meant to kill them. One might ask, what brought Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney to the attention of the FBI? The answer lies in the fact that Northern California Earth First had begun to build the first ever coalition between environmentalists and timber workers. Judy Barry was a blue-collar worker and union organizer in Maryland before she moved west, where she raised her children and worked as a carpenter in Mendocino County, California. It was these labor union roots that she brought with her to the struggle to save California's old-growth redwood forests. Judy Barry built bridges across cultural, class, and racial divides. She brought loggers, who had worked these rural lands for generations, together with young idealistic environmentalists who were committed to preventing the destruction of the redwood forest. Workers and environmentalists were poised to take on the timber companies, clear-cut and run logging practices that were destroying not only the forest, but were also jeopardizing the livelihoods of entire working communities. In fact, to the timber companies, this new Logger Earth First Alliance was a declaration of war.
Ain't no place for a face to hide from God and the FBI.
In 1997, Judy Barry, weakened by two assassination attempts and in constant pain, succumbed to breast cancer and died at the age of 47, leaving behind her two young daughters, Lisa and Jessica. Longtime Earth First organizer Karen Pickett welcomed over 1,000 people to a memorial in Judy Berry's honor at Martin Luther King Jr. School in Berkeley, California.
People talk about Judy. A lot of superlatives keep popping up. David Brower called her an ardent defender of justice, and Holly Neer used the words vibrant and articulate. And you'll hear other words over and over again, like feisty and fiery and funny. Judy was outrageously funny. She was really the queen of the quips. And at a time very shortly after she was bombed, when she was dealing with the tremendous pain and horror of what had happened, she said things like, well, they bombed the wrong end of me. And then later she said, well, I sure hope the FBI finds the bomber and fires him. She was a brilliant strategist, and she had the ability to recognize the point in time to bring in different tactics or different organizing strategies that would change the course of a campaign. And Redwood Summer was a good example of that. And she was the one who recognized that it was the point in time to start doing national mass organizing on the Redwoods issue. Judy was a true revolutionary. She was an in-the-trenches activist who not only made the speeches and raised the money and did the organizing, but she also did the mailings and made the phone calls and took care of all the little details. She was a leader, but she didn't put herself above any kind of work. And speaking of work, we're on the brink of a lot of activity right now. And Judy's case, as many of you know, is closer than ever to trial. We all need to make sure that case proceeds and wins, exposing the FBI's dirty deeds and getting a step closer to find out who bombed Judy Berry. We need to make sure that no more ancient trees and headwaters fall to Charles Hurwitz's axe. We need to make sure that the FBI doesn't get away with their lethal policies of squashing dissident activity. And Judy often said of her fight against the FBI, this is not about me, this is about activist people everywhere. This is about the Black Panthers. This is about the American Indian movement. This is about the Puerto Rican Independentistas. This is about all of us. For that reason, the spirit of Judy Berry lives on in her work and in all of us who carry on that work. Viva Judy Berry.
Cutting down the forest, hauling it away. Rumble of your lumber trucks at the break of day. Last of the baby redwoods, hit that forest floor. Run them through your chipper to make your way for Fort LP. 200,000 acres without stopping. Forest to a desert in a day. Modern forestry is so amazing. Let the future generation pace. LP.
In a speech at Humboldt State University, Judy Berry describes Redwood Summer.
Redwood Summer was planned in response to the timber companies having an accelerated cutting schedule. They were cutting faster than they are now because they don't have any trees left there anymore. Headwaters Forest was being threatened. A lot of activists and EPIC and other groups had gotten together a voter initiative called Forest Forever. The timber companies planned on cutting down every tree they could that summer so that the vote would be as moot as possible if it won. So our plan with Redwood Summer was to block every tree from being cut down that we could. The plan was to physically slow them down using nonviolent civil disobedience.
This is a song I wrote for Judy after we were bombed. Even though I was in the car, Judy was the target of that bomb. It was under her seat.
Now Judy Berry is a wobbly organizer, a Mother Jones at the Georgia Pacific Mill. She fought for the sawmill workers hit by that PCB spill. T. Marshall Hunt's calling GD shots from Atlanta. Don Nelson sold in the Union long ago. Now they weren't gonna have no wobbly running their logging show. So they spewed out their hatred and they laid out their scam. Jerry Philbrick called for violence. Was no secret what they planned. So I ask him, who bombed Judy Barry?
Carl Anthony, president of Earth Island Institute and Urban Habitat.
It is a long journey in time, space, and political consciousness from the sweltering heat of Noshiba County, Mississippi, where Michael Schwerner, James Cheney, and Andrew Goodman were murdered in 1964 at the beginning of Mississippi summer, to the timber wars of the Pacific Northwest, which led to the car bombing in 1990 of Judy Barry and Darryl Cherney for their politics of resistance in organizing Redwood Summer. Judy Barry was 15 years old when the militant activist of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee called upon the young people from college campuses to mobilize a massive force of volunteers as field workers in Mississippi to call national and international attention to the voting rights of black sharecroppers in the lowlands of the Deep South. And a quarter of a century later, many people had forgotten the lessons of 1964. To reach the northwest primeval forest from the lowlands of the South, one must traverse the Mississippi bottoms, the sea of grass in the middle states, the high plateau of Colorado, New Mexico, and Arizona, the great and thirsty American desert, the double rim of the Rocky Mountains and the Pacific Coast ranges. But the journey in political consciousness is perhaps as long and equally complex and torturous. The politics then and now challenge us to reconcile and to reconsider our understanding of rural versus urban, native people versus immigrants, working people versus corporate managers and investors, nonviolence versus violence, the rights of nature versus the prerogatives of people. Judy Barry and her supporters, unlike many of us, made that complex and torturous journey. And she made that journey for those of us who now are left behind. Some of us wanted to believe that we could have social justice and destroy the basis of life on the planet. Others wanted to believe that we could save the trees and tell poor people and working people and the people of color to go to hell. But Judy Barry was different. She taught us that the rights of nature and the rights of working people are cut from the same cloth. In 1990, a group of 150 civil rights organizations sent a letter to the established environmental organizations in this country accusing them of racism. And in January of that year marked the emergence, the public emergence of the environmental justice movement. In the same month, Judy Barry and her colleagues announced a campaign modeled on Mississippi Summer, which came to be known as Redwood Summer. During Redwood Summer, Earth First brought thousands of protesters to the Pacific Northwest to save the primeval redwood forest. The press and the corporations did not want us to know that Judy was inspired by the civil rights movement, and that her uncompromising stand to save the trees, that she was also uncompromising in her commitments to the timber workers, to their occupational health and safety, to their rights to participate in the decisions that affect their lives. Corporate leaders wanted us to believe that the choice was between environmental protection and jobs, but Judy knew better. In reality, she taught us that the interests of the timber workers and the interests of environmentalists were one and the same. The real choice was between worship of greed and private profit versus respect for life. In her efforts to bring militant environmentalists and timber workers together, Judy Barry stands on the shoulders of Henry David Thoreau, advocate of the rights of nature, protester against the fugitive slave law. Thoreau, who spent the night in jail in an act of resistance against the Mexican-American War, wrote his famous essay, Civil Disobedience, inspiring Tolstoy, Mahatma Gandhi, and Martin Luther King. Judy Barry stands on the shoulders of Mahatma Gandhi, who through nonviolent civil disobedience led his people from under the shackles of the British colonialism. Judy stands on the shoulders of Martin Luther King, cut down in his prime defending garbage workers. She stands on the shoulders of Chico Mendez, who organized the rubber tappers of Brazil to protect their rights and to save the rainforest. I want to leave with a recollection of an experience that I had of a funeral that occurred when I first came to Berkeley in the early 1970s. It was the funeral of George Jackson, who was killed at San Quentin. And I want to leave you with the words of his mother, who stood in the sun while hundreds of us came to mourn George Jackson, and we waited in line for almost an hour to get to shake the hands of this wonderful woman. And I looked into her eyes, and she looked at me, and she said, "Don't cry, fight."
Gene Lawhorn is a union carpenter and a former mill worker.
My first contact with Judy was through the written word of the Industrial Worker. I wrote a letter to Judy in answer to an article that she wrote seeking contact with environmental wood products workers. That was around the summer of 89. I had just come back after 5 months on the picket line at Roseburg Forest Products. And sometime in February of 1990, Judy called me to ask me to participate in a panel with her at the University of Oregon's Land, Air, and Water Conference on the subject of bridging the gap between workers and environmentalists. But when Judy approached the panel organizers, she had to threaten to boycott to get me on that panel. That was my first experience with Judy and her efforts to bust classism within the environmental movement. It was at that conference in March of 1990 that I challenged Earth First activists to renounce tree spiking if they truthfully desired to bridge the gap between workers and environmentalists. To my surprise and everyone else's surprise, Judy Berry stood up and she proclaimed that she agreed with me and hereby renounced the tactic of tree spiking. About a month after the conference, under Judy's leadership, Northern California and Willamette Earth First groups publicly renounced tree spiking in an effort to further reach out to working folks in the timber industry, and thus she made history. She went to the front lines and stood front and center to fight for working people and the ancient forest. To Judy, it was all one struggle, and it was about social justice. She was able to tie the issues of forest protection and workplace justice together like no one else could. And that's why she was bombed, and that's why the FBI attempted to frame her and Daryl Cherney for the bombing. It scared the hell out of the resource extractive industries to think that we as workers and environmentalists might get together to really challenge their power. It's the same way they reacted back in 1877. Latimer, Ward Homestead, Verdun, Ludlow, Everett, Centralia, Matewan, and on to the many other cities and times across this nation when U.S. troops and detective agency death squads massacred working people, their wives, their children, when they dared to fight for better working and living conditions.
Well, I come from a long, long line of tree-falling men. And this company town was here before my grandpappy settled in. We kept enough trees a standing so our kids could toe the line. But now a big corporation come and bought us out, got us working double time. But tell me, where are we gonna work when the trees are gone?
Judy Barry talks about organizing timber workers during a speech in Portland, Oregon.
What everybody has been asking me for the last 2 days, how do you organize timber workers? How do you organize loggers? How do you get loggers to talk to Earth Firsters? And the first answer is you have to like loggers. That's the first thing. And I already did because, you know, having been a blue-collar worker my whole adult life, the conditions of my life are actually more similar to them than to the privileged environmentalists in the city. The espresso-sucking pavement dwellers, as we call them. But so being from a rural area myself and being a working-class person myself, I can relate for those reasons. A lot of it really depends on your attitude. the thing that happens is people who are more educated or who are from urban areas tend to really look down, especially on rural working people. Actually, what I've discovered from a lifetime of being a non-achiever is that intelligence is it's equally distributed among the social classes. Dan Quayle is the perfect example of that. But there's a tendency of urban people to look down and consider the timber workers stupid, to talk down to them, to things like that. I've heard a 21-year-old college student say to a 45-year-old logger, "Do you know what biodiversity is?" And, you know, if you do that, that's the end of the conversation. So what I actually do is I just talk to people, that's all. I mean, it's been incredibly easy because there's nobody speaking for the timber workers out there. The wise use movement, the anti-environmentalists, those people are management. In fact, if you actually know them and who they are low-level management. They're fronting for the corporations, but they're not the workers. Nobody's speaking for the workers. The unions have mostly been smashed or corrupted themselves, and the actual interest of the workers is not expressed in the political spectrum in the timber wars. So what I did was, well, one of them is having some respect for them as intelligent human beings. Instead of telling the timber workers what to do, which is the other mistake environmentalists always make, I asked them. And I asked them to tell me about their working conditions and their lives. And the way I would meet them, by the way, is we blockade them. And, you know, here they are, and we're chained to their truck. They're not going anywhere. And that actually is really how I started meeting timber workers. And, you know, they're kind of curious about these people who are audacious enough to actually hike into the middle of nowhere in the woods and put their bodies on the line. So as I began to hear their stories, and I didn't even do this consciously, I began to give them a forum. By listening to them, by asking them instead of telling them, I really not only learned a lot of wisdom from them, but also began to build this alliance by advocating for the timber workers' issues in the community. And it didn't have to be save the trees. I advocated for workplace issues separately, understanding that it's the same thing, you know, that the workplace issues are neither separate from nor subordinate to the forest issues. They're all part of corporate exploitation of the earth and the people.
Berwyn stole Pacific lumber, used junk bonds to get the cash, left the mighty redwood forest a pile of broken slash. Ivan Boesky made his millions when a Max-Am deal was done, $1 billion paid with redwood blood and the workers' pension fund. Max-Am's on the horizon, head dollars seen in every redwood tree. Max-Am's on the horizon.
So when the bomb exploded, it was May 24th, 1990, and we were on our way to a concert in Santa Cruz where we were going to play songs and show a slideshow and recruit for Redwood Summer among the college students there.
Judy Barry in a talk at Humboldt State University.
I can't even describe how horrible it was. I can tell you I knew it was a bomb the second that it exploded. I felt it rip through me with just a force more powerful and terrible than anything that I could describe. But the horror of this experience didn't end with the bombing itself, because within minutes of the bombing, the FBI terrorist squad from the San Francisco FBI office was on the scene. And I literally mean this, within minutes, certainly within a half hour. According to their own records, the first record we have of their being on the scene is a log by the Oakland police. And 25 minutes after the bomb explodes, they recount their conversations with the FBI agents. So they were there pretty fast, considering that this was in Oakland and that FBI office is in San Francisco. And what the FBI did, arriving on the scene immediately, actually my lawyer wrote in the brief, the FBI was there in a trice, almost as if they had been standing around the corner holding their ears. But at any rate, they, whether or not they were standing around the corner holding their ears, they were certainly there quickly. And what they did was they quickly kind of took control of the scene. And they talked to the Oakland police, who were the responding agency. And what they did is they said to the Oakland police, they said, "We know these people. These people are terrorists." And literally what they said, this was testified by Sergeant Sitterud of the Oakland police. He said, "They told us that these were the kind of people who would carry a bomb. They told us that these people, in fact, qualified as terrorists." With that, the Oakland police were a lot more willing to, they have a long relationship with the FBI anyway, certainly going back to the days of the Black Panthers, and with this stuff being told to them by the FBI, they were willing to cooperate. But it's not just that they accidentally thought that I bombed myself. What we've found is that they told some very, very deliberate lies. And you can't really excuse the Oakland police for going along with it, because these lies were so obvious that anybody with a set of eyes in their head could have seen them. First thing they said, and this was from FBI Special Agent Frank Doyle, and Frank Doyle was their bomb expert on the terrorist squad. So the reasons for the arrest are laid out in the search warrant. And what it says in there is, it says, the Oakland police say, I viewed the bombed car along with Special Agent Frank Doyle of the FBI. Frank Doyle informed me that the bomb was on the backseat floorboard, and therefore they should have seen it, and therefore they knew that they were carrying it. Well, years later, as this lawsuit has progressed, we've gotten hold of the Oakland police's own photos. Now, the place where Frank Doyle testified the bomb was right where you put your feet when you're sitting in the back seat. And this, of course, is under the seat. And any idiot could see this. You don't have to be a bomb expert to see that this bomb was not in the back seat. So at that point began an incredible press smear. From the moment that this bomb went off, went an incredible press smear nationwide. It's the only time we ever made the front page of the New York Times. And what this press smear was to tell people that we were terrorists who had blown ourselves up with our own bomb. Although we can't get anything that we actually do, we can't get it in the newspapers, this one got picked up all over the place. There were selected leaks and innuendos given out by the FBI and the Oakland police in order to convince people that not only are we violent terrorists who carry bombs around in our car, but we're stupid violent terrorists who carry them under our own car seat.
Ed Herman is an economist, media analyst, and co-author with Noam Chomsky of Manufacturing Consent.
The police case, as we know, was built on a lie that an honest media would have uncovered and publicized. But the mainstream media swallowed that lie, and they swallowed the position of the police and the FBI almost uniformly. And their bias in the treatment of the bombing and the underlying issues was blatant. It was so blatant, in fact, that I used the newspaper reports of that time for some years as a case study in a course I gave at Penn on media bias. The New York Times had a front page article by a woman named Catherine Bishop. It's on May 26, 1990. And this article in itself is a beautiful illustration of media bias, and it's worth thinking about, I think. In this article, the police FBI version, you know, was totally controlling of the structure of the article. The first subhead of the article had a quote. It said, meant to be used, unquote. And it meant that the police version was that Barry and Czerny intended to use it. That gets into the quote, and the whole first couple of paragraphs of the article is about the police version that they were transporting the bomb. Then the second heading in the article is called, Other Groups Are Wary, references to tree spiking and all the negatives that contributed to making it look like this was a dangerous group. The language that was used was also incredibly illuminating. For example, in the very first paragraph, this reporter says, supporters of Earth First were, quote, quick to denounce the charges. Police and the FBI were there instantaneously. Never does the author suggest that they were quick to blame the Earth Firsters. No. Here's another beautiful piece of language. The aim of the Earth First was to, quote, stop the harvesting of old-growth redwoods. That is key. It's sort of like you're collecting apples this year, from harvesting this year these 2,000-year-old redwoods. You're harvesting. And later in the article, this reporter further says the tension was rising because of what Earth First was intending to do. Then the same reporter, a couple weeks later, had another article where she talked about tensions rising because of Earth First intention to use tactics like sitting in trees. And, of course, one fundamental form of bias is that you treat the police and FBI as sacred. This reporter never suggested there's any question of the police and FBI credibility.
Michael Parenti is a noted political writer and the author of History as Mystery and Against Empire.
There's often something important that's left unsaid when commemorating the life of someone like Judy Barry. It's important to speak of her marvelous qualities, her capacity to lead, organize, inspire, and get results. But we must also say something about the price she paid at the hands of our enemies. Alexander Coburn begins the column he wrote on her in The Nation with, quote, "Cancer nailed poor Judy Barry," unquote. Putting aside the insensitive phrasing by Alexander, cancer didn't nail her. The repressive state killed her, I believe. They subjected her to death threats and assaults. They ran her car off the road, then set off a bomb under her car seat that tore and mangled her previously vibrant, healthy body, causing lasting damage to her health and her immune system. From then on, she lived in serious pain and discomfort, and her health became a more tenuous thing. She was subjected to the additional stress of being charged with the very crime that was committed against her. I believe Judy succumbed to cancer because of the immense physical damage done to her. I believe she would be alive today if it weren't for that bomb. I accuse the state of murdering Judy Barry. The state eventually had to drop charges against her and Daryl Cherney because of lack of evidence, of course. But they investigated no further. They never tried to find out who tried to assassinate her and Daryl. Brothers and sisters, it's not enough to denounce this action. We must also ask why. Why do public servants behave in this manner? Because they are not serving the public. Because their job is to suppress those groups that put people before profits, to make the world safe for global investment and accumulation, for privilege and wealth, for power and hierarchy. The mandate of all security agencies is to infiltrate, undermine, disrupt, and in other ways neutralize progressive activist groups, alternative media, and anyone else who puts people before profits. There are some people on the left who just don't get it. They say, "Aren't you being paranoid?" I mean, they recognize that the U.S. national security state agencies commit such crimes in El Salvador, Guatemala, and scores of other countries around the world. But they wouldn't do that here. There's no counterinsurgency here, no. Then tell us who planted that bomb in Judy's car. Was it the Tooth Fairy? We hear from centrists that the FBI must keep tabs on extremists on both sides, the left and the right. But people like Judy who protect the environment are not extremists. The extremists are the people who destroy the environment. The ones... the ones whom the FBI and other domestic counterinsurgency agencies are dedicated to protecting. The extremists are already in power. As for the right-wing extremists, you know, the Klan and the Nazi nuts and those guys, well, in fact, undercover agents actually assist them. They assisted the Klan and the Nazi groups that massacred those communists in Greensboro, North Carolina some years back. They supplied them with arms and with maps and how to get there to Greensboro. They assisted in building secret army groups that have committed acts of terror against reformists and other activists. They move against the right themselves only when it gets out of hand and attacks banks and public agencies. And even then, only rather lackadaisically. Soon after Judy died, I heard an obituary on Pacifica or NPR, I'm not sure which. It's getting hard to tell them apart, it's true. So this commentator, whose name escapes me, who sounded cautiously sympathetic toward Judy in that NPR or Pacifica way, he said, quote, "Judy Barry was loved by some and hated by some," unquote. I said to myself, ooh, such balanced journalism. Such balance. How objective, I said. That reporter's going to go far. He could spin off a few more balanced sentences like that, and he'll get mainstreamed and probably end up on NBC and all that. Judy was loved by some and hated by some. Wrong. She was loved by many and hated by those privileged few who seek to plunder our natural resources for fast profits. She was hated by those who treat human beings, animals, and the environment itself as dispensable resources for their accumulation process. I'm giving you yet another reason why we can love and respect Judy, for the enemies she made as well as the friends.
Karen Pickett, longtime Earth First activist and supporter of Leonard Peltier, explains how the FBI infiltrated and disrupted Earth First prior to the car bomb assassination attempt against Judy Barry and Daryl Cherney.
Well, as you hear people's stories, the picture that emerges is one that shows that the dark age of domestic spying and covert action against progressives has never ended. In the late 80s, the FBI spent about $3 million, conducted over 1,000 hours of wiretapping, engaged 50 FBI agents, some of whom wore body wires to get more recordings, to set up a sting operation of the perceived leaders of Earth First and to associate Earth First with explosives. This happened in Arizona, and it was called Operation ThermCon because the FBI's primary undercover agent and their hired informant tried over a period of many months to convince the Earth First activists to use thermite and dynamite to take down power lines. When they were unsuccessful at convincing them to use explosives, the informant trained one of the activists in the use of a cutting torch and an acetylene torch and drove the group of activists in his truck with FBI purchased gasoline out to the desert to cut down with a torch a transmission tower that brought power to the Central Arizona Project. Judy Barry called this the only Earth First FBI joint action, and in fact it was. The point is, they weren't busting a bombing conspiracy, they were creating one. And in related harassment, there have been grand juries convened in a number of different states over the last decade, calling scores of Earth First activists before secret proceedings. And there have been a lot of other incidents where we see the same tactics coming up that we've seen used against the Black Panthers, the American Indian Movement, the Puerto Rican Independence Movement, CISPACE. Tactics like forged mail, fake propaganda, disinformation, and in the case of the other movements, even lethal force. The dirty tricks, COINTELPRO style, against the environmental movement really just ushered in a new era, but brought us to make even deeper connections with these other movements that we already had political connections with. And this is something that Judy Barry always maintained, that solidarity with these other movements is of utmost importance. And as we stand up to this repression, we're also in damn good company.
Judy Barry describes Bomb School, an FBI training exercise held on Louisiana Pacific land just 1 month before her car was blown up.
I thought the FBI was evil before all this stuff happened, but my cynicism has had a very hard time keeping up with reality in this case, because this one even shocked me. What we discovered in the course of the depositions is that 1 month before the bomb went off in my car on May 24th, 1990, almost exactly a month to the date, the FBI conducted a bomb school, their words, in Eureka, California, up in the Redwood region. And what they did at bomb school was they blew up cars with pipe bombs and practiced responding. And the teacher of bomb school was Special Agent Frank Doyle, the very same one who took over the scene. And the students at bomb school included at least five, and we're trying to find out more, of the responding officers who worked under him picking up the debris. So when we asked Sergeant Hansen from the Oakland police, how could you say that this bomb was in the back seat, he said, well, if Frank Doyle was my teacher, I wasn't about to contradict him. So certainly he set up a line of authority with that. But then there's something else that they did. The other thing I need to say about bomb school is the place where they held this bomb school, the place where they blew up these cars was on Louisiana Pacific land. And Louisiana Pacific, of course, being one of our principal adversaries. And, we asked if Louisiana Pacific security was there. And, well, yes, they would be there to secure their interests. So this alliance of LP and the FBI and this exercise of blowing up cars and practicing responding with the very, virtually what they did, Frank Doyle told the class at bomb school, he said that when people bomb each other, they hardly ever put the bomb inside the passenger compartment because it's allegedly so hard to break into a car. Okay. Instead, he says they strap it underneath the car or they put it in the engine. And so since one of the reasons that they say they knew that this was my bomb was because the bomb was inside the passenger compartment. And so if you think about what he's doing here, I you can take your choice how to describe this. You can either be a conspiracy theorist or you can be a coincidence theorist. But one way or another, 1 month before the bombing, Frank Doyle told the people that this bomb scene, they actually created the same crime scene that they were about to respond to. They blew up 3 cars. We said, well, where were the bombs in the cars that they blew up? 2 out of 3 were in the passenger compartment. What he's doing is he's created virtually the same crime scene that they're about to respond to, and he's told them that this crime scene is not consistent with the victim of a bombing. It's consistent with transporting a bomb. In addition to setting up this line of authority, Frank Doyle also prejudiced people's response. So I'm not saying that bomb school means that they had prior knowledge of the bomb. We'll have to wait and see about that one. But it certainly did those 2 things. It certainly prejudiced the respondents and it set up a line of authority.
What they did to us was, the term for this in the FBI is COINTELPRO, Counterintelligence Program. And what that means, this is a program that was started by J. Edgar Hoover back in the bad old days, and now in the bad new days, they still do it. And COINTELPRO, that J. Edgar Hoover described, it's a way of targeting domestic radical groups that they think are a threat to the U.S. government. So I guess that's quite a compliment to us. I guess we're a threat to Charles Hurwitz, and he's more powerful than the government, so maybe it all adds up. But anyway, what J. Edgar Hoover described COINTELPRO as a program, these are his words, to expose, misdirect, isolate, and neutralize political groups that he didn't like. And that's really what's been done to Earth First. And the methods that they used in COINTELPRO include disinformation, fake documents, infiltration, agent provocateurs, fomenting infighting within a group, getting the group to do things so that they will be discredited, and also framing and assassinating leaders. And the most famous victims of COINTELPRO, well, you probably all know that Martin Luther King was spied on in his motel room. And that, you know, of course, in the Black Panthers, there were many Panthers killed, 32 in all. Fred Hampton was a famous victim of COINTELPRO. He was murdered in his bed. Geronimo Pratt, he, in fact, was framed by the very same guy Richard Held. The same guy that was in charge of our case at the FBI was in charge of Geronimo's case down in Los Angeles. And what they did, and of course, Leonard Peltier is another very well-known victim of COINTELPRO. And what they did in these cases, I actually brought you some examples to show you. They did the exact kind of thing that I'm talking about. In the Black Panthers, they didn't just frame Geronimo. Before they framed him and put him in jail, they fomented infighting within the leadership so that people in the Black Panthers thought that Geronimo was an FBI agent. So that when he was then framed, the other Panthers wouldn't testify in his behalf. And one of the ways that they fomented this infighting is that they had these like nasty cartoons. Now, the FBI doesn't make up the divisions in your group. They take real divisions and they kind of fan the flames of them. So there was another group, a Black nationalist group, and the other group was called United Slaves, or US, U.S. And the leader of the United Slaves was named Karenga. So what they did is they had these cartoons, and these cartoons were sent from one faction to the other and back and forth, cartoons, death threats, and insulting letters. And each faction thinking that the cartoons and letters were from the other faction, and they were all from the FBI until everybody, well, actually, there were actually 2 Panthers killed in the fighting that resulted from this, which they considered a great success. So eventually, COINTELPRO was exposed, and it was exposed not because of anything the U.S. government did, but because in 1971, some people, we know not who, broke into the FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, and liberated the files. And back then, they used to be very open. They called it COINTELPRO. They said, we have an order to neutralize Huey Newton. They even had an order to neutralize Tom Hayden. They got these files, about 10,000 pages of them, and they went through them, and they exposed this just really horrible program. And it took them 4 years to get a congressional hearing. But they eventually got a congressional hearing in the Senate before Senator Church. It was called the Church Committee, and this was in 1975. And at that time, they ruled, the U.S. Senate Committee, ruled that COINTELPRO was illegal, that it violated basic constitutional rights of U.S. citizens. And as a result of this, you may have heard of the Attorney General guidelines. This is what's kind of being undermined by the counterterrorism bill. So they passed these things called the Attorney General guidelines, and they set rules for the FBI and what they could and couldn't do. And what they said they couldn't do is they cannot spy on people, they cannot harass people, they can't engage with people because of political activities. That's what they're banned from doing. They're only allowed to investigate crime. They're not allowed to investigate radical political groups or any political group.
Now Judy Barry is an Earth First organizer. The California Redwoods are her home. Now she called for Redwood Summer, where the owl and the black bear roam. Charlie Hurwitz, he runs Max Am out of Houston. Harry Merlo runs LP from Portland Town. They're the men they call King Timber. They know how to cut you down. And Chef Tucker spewed their hatred as Candy Boak laid out their scam. John Campbell called for violence. Was no secret what they planned. So I ask you now, who bought? Seen her broken body, or the spirit you can't kill.
Geronimo G. Jaga was recently released from prison after spending 27 years for a crime he did not commit. He was framed by FBI Special Agent Richard W. Held.
Before I left prison, Judy contacted me, and I think it's very important that we understand the connections in all of our struggles. And this is what Judy exemplified and personified in so many ways. Hell and his daddy, that's the biggest criminal gang in the history of the United States, and it's called the FBI. And what Hell did, what this pig did in 1969 in Los Angeles, was create a situation between the US organization and the Black Panther Party, which resulted in three deaths, known deaths, and we know there were more. And they bragged about it. They took credit for it, and they gave each other medals for straight-up murder of beautiful young warriors who were out not to rob, not to rape, not to do nothing but feed some children and contribute to a process that had still been evolving out of slavery. They're dead. Hell killed them. And so we have to look at that and use that to unify us based on the understanding that we have a common enemy. We're dealing with some Nazis, the same mentality of genocide and racism and everything that goes with it. Whatever we could do, we're going to do, especially in continuing to preserve this earth and protecting it from all of these exploitative, avaricious pigs that don't care nothing about Mother Earth. And down home, I want you to know you're welcome to come down to the Atchafalaya swamplands and understand the culture down there, understand the history down there. Right in the cypress swamps outside of New Orleans, between where I grew up and the city of New Orleans, was the biggest slave uprising during slavery of 1811. But you don't know that, and you don't know that it could not have been done without the Chitimacha, without the Hummer, without the Cato, without the Chacahula, without the native Chapatula, the native people who came together with the runaway slave, with the guerrilla slave, to defeat the slaveocracy. And it's very important that you know that, because all of it was based on Earth First.
Jose Lopez, director of the Puerto Rican Cultural Center in Chicago, is a professor at Northeastern Illinois University and Columbia College.
Today, as you think and reflect on the courage and life, and obviously the legacy of Judy Barry, one of the headlines in one of the newspapers, the major newspaper of Puerto Rico, is that the FBI is turning over 1 million pages of COINTELPRO documents to the Puerto Rican Senate. We discover that in Puerto Rico, 155,000 people had files by the Puerto Rican police and the FBI. 155,000 adults constitutes 5% of the adult population of Puerto Rico. 1 million pages, this is only the tip of the iceberg. 1 million pages that will not tell, obviously, the role of the FBI in the assassinations of nearly a dozen Puerto Ricans. Richard Held went from Pine Ridge Reservation in 1975-76 to go to Chicago. And as a matter of fact, I was jailed for refusing to testify before a grand jury in 1977. I was called before the grand jury in 1976. And dozens of Puerto Ricans and their allies were called before grand juries. And many of us went to prison for refusing to testify before that grand jury. And Richard Held carried out that operation from Chicago. And from Chicago, he went to San Juan, Puerto Rico. Interestingly enough, he ends up being the head of the FBI in Puerto Rico in 1979. How can an empire like this stand before the world and say that it is fighting for democracy and human rights in Kosovo and elsewhere in the world? How is it that a man like Richard Held continues to be, and people like him continue to be, on the payroll of the FBI, on your payroll because you pay those taxes? What we are seeing in a lot of these situations, and maybe what you will see even in the case of Judy Berry, is that ultimately what the U.S. is engaged in and has been engaging in at least the last 20, 25 years is a different vision about the world. And it's a vision about the fact that throughout the world, they are causing a great deal of problems and damages. And throughout the world, people are resisting. And what Subcomandante Marcos calls the pockets of resistance. And these pockets of resistance are basically challenging this empire all over the world. So I would hope you would keep this in mind. And I would hope you would keep in mind this idea that against the empire of the money bags is the will of the people in these pockets of resistance.
Ramona Africa is the sole adult survivor of the May 13, 1985 police massacre of 11 men, women, and children and MOVE members in Philadelphia.
On the move, long live Mama, long live Judy. First thing that I want to say is that Judy Berry was a warrior. She was a fighter. Judy realized what this system is doing to all of us. You know, ain't no shortcuts. Ain't no talking up a revolution. If we truly admire Judy Berry, if we truly believe in what she stands for, then we have to continue that work. Not just leave here today and say it was a good program. That's what the system want people to do. You know, that ain't getting it. So in the spirit of Judy Berry, on the move, long live revolution. Long live all freedom fighters. On the move, and long live John Adams.
FBI is back again with COINTELPRO. Richard Held is the man they know they trust, with Lieutenant Sims, his henchman. The world of boom and bust. But we'll answer with nonviolence, for seeking justice is our plan. And we'll avenge our wounded comrades as we defend the ravaged land. So I ask you now, who bombed Judy Berry?
On May 24, 1990, Earth First organizers Judy Berry and Darryl Cherney were targets of a car bomb assassination attempt in Oakland, California, as they were on their way to a Redwood summer organizing event. The bombing was preceded by an aggressive campaign of death threats and harassment aimed at stopping their nonviolent defense of Northern California's ancient Redwood Forest. Within minutes of the blast, the FBI was on the scene and had Judy and Darryl arrested for transporting explosives. Government agents immediately orchestrated a national media smear campaign, painting these nonviolent activists as terrorists. This campaign was clearly intended to discredit Earth First and to neutralize the activists' successful coalition with loggers and timber workers. No legitimate investigation of this near-deadly car bombing was ever conducted. The real bombers were never apprehended and remain at large. Nearly killed by the blast, Judy Barry was left permanently disabled and in constant pain. She died in March 1997 of breast cancer. Her estate, on behalf of her two young daughters, Lisa and Jessica Barry, is pursuing Barry versus USA, a federal civil rights lawsuit against the Federal Bureau of Investigation and the Oakland Police. The Redwood Justice Fund seeks to protect every activist's right to work for social justice without fear of government and corporate violence and repression. Whenever people resist corporate control of the environment with humor, direct action, and successful strategies, and everywhere people stand in solidarity across race, class, and cultural divides, Judy Barry will live on.
Ain't no place for a face to hide from God and the FBI.
Revolutionary Ecology was produced by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Prison Radio is a project of the Redwood Justice Fund. It was engineered by Anita Johnson and David Kaplowitz. Excerpts of Judy Barry's speeches were taken from Who Bombed Judy Barry on Alternative Tentacles Records. I'm Ruby Dee. Thank you for listening.
That was Revolutionary Ecology, featuring Judy Barry's speeches and the comments of those who struggled for justice with her. For Visa and MasterCard orders for the complete one-hour program you just heard, Judy Barry, Revolutionary Ecology, call us toll-free 1-800-444-1977. Again, that toll-free number is 1-800-444-1977. I'm Noel Hanrahan. Thank you for listening.
Revolutionary Ecology, as well as other tapes of interest, are available through the Alternative Radio website at www.alternativeradio.org.